go. All righty. Parshas Kisisa. Parshas Kisisa. Tavshinayin Aleph. Okay, here are the things on the agenda today. Again, we are dealing in this week's Parsha with very, very fundamental topics. The story of the Chet HaEgel. That's huge. The story of the Chet HaEgel, because we know that it follows us through the generations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, anytime I kind of, identify a flaw in Klal Yisrael to come down upon them for that flaw, you should know part of the flaw is the flaw of the Chet HaEgel. It remains with us. And we do tshuva for it, really. We bring it up every Yom Kippur. We talk about the Chet HaEgel, when the Kohen Gadol would bring a par in order to be mechaper, to atone for himself, which goes all the way back to the concept of the Chet HaEgel. In fact, the Mishkan, many elements in the Mishkan itself were because of the Chet HaEgel. So we have to talk about the Chet HaEgel, but we're going to talk about it from this angle. We're going to talk about it from the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself defines the absolute, the core problem that led to the Chet HaEgel. When Hashem speaks to Moshe on this week's Parsha, he says to Moshe, they've sinned, etc., they've gone wild, and he refers to Klal Yisrael in his declaration that he's going to punish them if Moshe doesn't intercede on their behalf, right? He says, leave me alone and I'll punish them, which means, if you don't leave me alone, I won't, right? He refers to Klal Yisrael as Am Kishei Oref. That is what we're working on today. A stiff-necked people. What is that? What does that mean? What's the neck? What is a stiff neck? Kishei Oref. Okay? So we're linking a couple of ideas together, and they're not just linked here. Your minds will start roaming, and you'll see they're linked in other places also. We're thinking about an Egel. Right, a Chet HaEgel, bull, right? An Egel is a shor, a bull. The mida of a bull, what a bull is known for. Well, in bullfights, why do they use bulls? What's the part of the drama and the fun? And why do they attack? What's his called?
The matador,
right? What's his purpose? What's he trying to do to the bull? It's not just kill him outright. The drama comes from the teasing, making the bull angry. Ka'as relates, the bull is the example of ka'as, anger, fury. Charon af, Hashem says, hanichali, leave me alone. Vayichar apiba, my nose, so to speak, will flare. That's the image of the bull, the flaring, raging, angry bull, right? So we're talking about an egel. We're talking about Hashem responding to Avodah Zarah with the concept of the rage and the flaring bull, the flaring nose, nostrils. We're talking about stiff neck. Bull has, by the way, a very stiff neck, a very thick neck. And just think for a second here. Can you put together the concept of an egel and a neck from another place? An egel and a neck. Good. Egla Arufa. Exactly. Egla Arufa. There are two types of deaths that we find ourselves confronting. One is natural death of a human being, in which case we have to neutralize the tuma, the impurity of it, with a para, same thing, a cow, a para aduma. That's death, normal death, death that comes into the world. But if it's death by the hands of another human being, it's not the para aduma, it's the egla arufa. It's the egel that you break its neck, like she'oref. It's a definite relationship there. By the way, another place the egla arufa comes up, not just in Parsha Shoftim, which talks about the halacha, but with Yosef and Yaakov. Remember that strange thing? We'll go back and look at it. That Yosef sent agalot, wagons, which is a veiled reference to the message he gave his brothers, that if Yaakov doesn't believe that he's alive, and not just alive, why would they come and say he's alive if he's dead? So clearly it's not that, but that he's alive as Yosef in his righteousness, he should show him, they should tell Yaakov that Yosef still remembers and is still involved with the last halacha you were learning before you were parted, which is Egla Arufa. How does that message come into play? Egla Arufa, I didn't absolutely define it, is this, that there's a halacha that if a person is found dead in no man's land between two cities, right? So the city that the corpse is found closest to is held accountable. Why didn't they escort him? Why didn't they take care of him? What happened here? And the leaders of that town have to break the neck of an egel. And this is all obviously very representative of what's going on here, and say we are not guilty. We are not responsible for this. We took good care of him. We took him in. We gave him the protection, the food, whatever was, this happened, it was beyond our control, which means there's an implied guilt that you didn't treat him as one of yours. You didn't take care of him. So all of this has to come together. Egel, Kshei Oref, the neck, Egla Arufa, breaking the neck when somebody dies outside of, and who's responsible. Hashem saying that leave me alone and my anger will flare like a shor, like a bull. Okay? And come to an understanding of what is the sin of the Egel, and more than that, the perpetrators of the sin are the, who do we always blame? The Erev Rav. Now, we know we have some known enemies. We have Yishmael, and we have Esav, and we have another group called the Erev Rav, but the problem with the Erev Rav is they're part of us. They're hard to distinguish. And obviously, the concept of the Erev Rav is also a concept that philosophically, the Erev Rav that exists within us represents a Mida that it's very, very hard, a character trait to separate ourselves from. And we know that the Erev Rav figure very greatly in, the Gra goes into great lengths about this, the Vilna Gaon, and all kinds of Balei Machshavot philosophers, the Ramchal and everyone, they talk about that the end of the last Gullus, after there's the Gullus of that, after the Gullus of the Gullus of Bavel and Paras and Madai, and then you have Yavon, and then you have Rome, which is Esav, then you have Yishmael and Esav together, right? Edom and Esav together. And the last quality of the last Gullus is the Erev Rav. In fact, Daniel envisioned four beasts, in which represented the different forces that arise against us. And the last one is the Erev Rav, and not even the Erev Rav by themselves, but the Erev Rav indistinguishable from Klal Yisrael. When Klal Yisrael are so influenced by the Erev Rav, that's like the last beast of all the beasts. So what is the Erev Rav? Okay, those mixed multitude that Moshe included and allowed to come into Klal Yisrael. These are our jobs today. Okay, now to start with, what is Kshei Oref? What does it mean, stiff neck? So the simple imagery of a neck, there's a front of a neck and a back of a neck. The oref is the back of the neck. It's the front of a person's head that has the eyes and all, the way we learn, the way we communicate, the humanity of a person is in the front. The back of the head, of the neck, is dumb and blind, dumb meaning unable to speak, and blind and passive and unproductive, and nothing comes from the back. So that's, first of all, that's the back. The neck is always seen in the images that it connects the head to the trunk, which when we talk about it means connecting the mind to the heart. So now we've spoken about this a lot in many different ways, okay? And what we mean is connecting what we know to be true with our natural gut reactions. Right, with what we want, connecting the mind and the heart. When the neck is broken, that's a clear symbolism that there's no connection, right? That there's no connection between the mind and the heart. When the neck is stiff, right? It's immovable. It means like it's very, very difficult, to get something to pass from the mind to the heart. There's a neck, but it's rigid. And you can't work with it. Okay, it's there, but it has a big problem. Think about it as, you know, stiff or inflexible or calcified or so Shei Orif, HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying it's that Mida that there's a separation, and it's a very difficult separation because there's no maneuverability here. That's what led to the Chet HaEgel, which is Avodah Zarah. So now we start talking about the concept of Avodah Zarah, making an image, and why that means that there's a big distance between the head and the heart. Here is Klal Yisrael, okay? And we say, how could they right after Har Sinai? Right? How could they? Right after Har Sinai. After they were so overawed, impressed, overwhelmed by their closeness to Kadosh Baruch Hu, how could they violate the second Dibra, don't make an image? Where does the desire to make an image come from? The fact that the image ended up as an egel, it represents exactly that desire. It was a manifestation of what led to it. It was a definition. It pointed back at them, this is where you are. This is a definition of yourself, this egel. Now, where does it come from? Where does it come from to create an image? So here, on the one hand, it's a very noble, expression of a person to make an image. Why, you go to the Grand Canyon, and you're very impressed by the greatness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the beauty of nature. It overwhelms you. You feel, you know, your heart is bursting with a sense of appreciation for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, an inspiration and a desire to know more, to come closer, to rededicate yourself, right? Inspiration. By the way, first thing people do when they feel inspired, an interesting response, they inhale like as if they could take it in. Neshama, neshima, we spoke about it last week, right? The smell, the sense of being alive, inspired. So then what do most people do, except some crazy people like myself who've been to so many places without ever having a camera, ever. You take a picture, right? Why do you take a picture? You take a picture to remember how you felt, so that when you look at it next time, you'll be inspired all over again. So what's wrong with that? That's good. People do it all the time. Right, you take a picture, so you have something you can carry with you, which is what the images were. They didn't have pictures or photographs that you can carry with you to remind you to be inspired. Okay, so theoretically that would be okay, except one problem. It came after Har Sinai. Really, we have a halacha. We have the second Dibra. You're not allowed to make an image. It's tselem. You can't make a tselem. By the way, a camera, as we call it today, a matzlema, right? You can't make an image. Why can we not make a tselem, an image or something outside of us that reminds us to be inspired? Because for Klal Yisrael, who experienced Har Sinai, and the purpose of Har Sinai was only that, the inspiration would become so embedded in the person that they turn only to themselves for their own inspiration. They don't need something externalized to give them inspiration. The inspiration wells up from within them because of the experiences they've had. In other words, we don't need a tselem because we are the tselem Elokim. It comes from inside. Now, if there never was a Har Sinai, then maybe an image could be, you know, excused. But to make an image after Har Sinai means this, and this is Kshei Orif. It means this, that getting to a point where the inspiration is within me, okay, is a very scary point for people, that people resist at all costs. Here, why do we resist that? Why did they go ahead and fight back to what they had, against what they had achieved at Har Sinai? It's a natural human response, and it's the most difficult response to extricate ourselves from, and that's why it's considered the last force of the last galus is this concept of what the Erev Rav encouraged us to do. When we, there are two types of methods of in a sense of acting, of two types of internal processes before we do something, okay? there's the process, and we've spoken about these ideas in different places when relating to different subjects, but hopefully things build or become cumulative, and the more applications and the more different examples, things take on a larger life. We have the first one way to respond or to choose to behave is when the knower, me, and the knowledge are distinct and separate from each other. There's me with my interests and my desires, and there's the knowledge that I have of what's right and what's good and what I should do or shouldn't do right now. Where I should act, where I should restrain myself, I know. And I feel compelled. This is a very high madriga. I feel compelled by the truth, by what I should do, by what's good for me, by what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. I feel compelled by it. And therefore, I push myself to respond to it, and I do the right thing, or I don't do the wrong thing. But in that scenario, the person is, in a sense, enslaved to the truth. And there's always a sense of slavery, of not being free. I'm acting because I have to, because I must, because I want to, because it's right, but I'm pushing myself to act because I have no choice. I'm bound to the truth that I know. I'm bound to the MS that I've, you know, that I'm not going to violate, and I'm going to do the right thing. But I am not really free. I am enslaved. I am you know, captured by my knowledge. That's a very, very high madriga. But there's something about it that doesn't feel as satisfying as when an urge arises within us, an impulse. And we satisfy it. We have a desire to say something, to do something, to respond to some situation in a certain way, emotionally, and we don't hold back, and we satisfy that need that we have, that emotional need. We satisfy, or we react to that desire that's welling up within us. That sense, that is a great experience of satisfaction. Huge satisfaction. You want something and you do it. You satisfy it. That, there's a certain freedom in that. Because what happens here is the person is not being compelled to do something. It's not that the person is forced to do something, pushing themselves to do something. It's more the person can't stop themselves from doing it. They can't stop. They must. It's calling for a response. And they respond. That is a sense of freedom, a sense where your heart is forcing you to want something and you react to it completely without any reservations. That is freedom in a certain sense. Now, when that impulse is for something that's good and that's right, and that we should do, and we have a desire to respond to it, to satisfy it, then what's happening is the inspiration to do what's right and what's good is coming from within ourselves, and we have no options but to satisfy it, to indulge, in a sense, that desire. That's the highest madriga. It's another way of saying you don't have bechira anymore. You've created such a love and a yearning and a craving and a taiva, like Rambam talks about in Hilchos Teshuvah, for the ways of Hashem, that in a sense you can't not. It's painful not to. So that is in a pure freedom to do what, in terms of the emes, that's real freedom. You're free to indulge your deepest instincts, which happen to be, because you've worked on it, what's perfectly true and right. That's freedom. You don't feel like you're forced into anything. Nothing's compelling you. It's your own desire that you are indulging, and it's pure freedom. And that's meant to be the highest madriga of all. Now, that's the madriga of the luchos, right? Proof. Give me the chazal that says it. That's for the compulsion aspect. What does it say? That the letters of the words, right, of the Aseres HaDibros, Cheirus, right? Cheirut. They were engraved. Chazal say, Charut. I'm sorry, Charut. Engraved. Chazal say, don't read it Charut, engraved. Cheirut, freedom. Now, why is engraved freedom? Because engraved is not imposed on top of the stone. Engraved is part and parcel of the stone. It's one. There's no separation. It's not external. So it's total freedom. The Madrega of the first Dibros, of that experience of Mamad Har Sinai, as we spoke about a couple weeks ago, and Matan Torah, the two experiences, right, of learning Torah and receiving the revelation much greater than they could have ever received in a normal state. Remember that? About learning Torah, being Talmidim a couple of weeks ago? That experience created a reality that their inner desire, it was like, as we say, the letters were engraved, were one with the truth. And that's their inspiration came within themselves. And in a sense, it's of no bechira there. Because you have to do what you want to do. You have to give in to your urges, which are to be attached to Hashem. And then you're compelled. Now, what did Klal Yisrael do? Which is really telling us what every human being does when the natural urge in a person is. We don't easily give up our autonomy to make our own choices, to be independent. We don't like that. It's very, to get to that madrega where a person, in a sense, gives away their bechira and creates a situation where their bechira is what's only right and good in Hashem's eyes, and that's the only thing they want, and they don't want anything else. They've gotten to a madrega where they've completely separated themselves from their ratzon, from their natural, human, typical, you know, average, you know, that 99.9% of humanity understands and feels regular human needs, desires, interests. They separated themselves from it, and they've so purified themselves by a constant, endless, ongoing, moment by moment, day to day, avoda, working on themselves, that they've separated themselves from any of these, you know, mundane desires or interests, and they've purified themselves to such a degree that their interests are only HaKadosh Baruch Hu's. Now, we know how we resist that. Nobody really wants to give up their sense of how they see things and how they want things and how they would set up things. And whenever we get into a conflict between what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says is true, which should be our will, and what our will still is, which might not be the same thing, generally that conflict is very difficult. And every time we get into it, you know, we feel the battle. And we try each time incrementally to, by doing the right thing, getting to a place where the right thing becomes what we want. But it's a battle. And a lot of times we're too weak to really succeed in that battle. We just do what we want to do anyway. Right? So when Klal Yisrael built an egel, created an image, what they were doing is this. The concept of the egel, and this is what Moshe Shapira talks about this in my Ma'amak, and most of these ideas are Moshe Shapira. What the Erevav encouraged Klal Yisrael, you know, a small portion, by the way, of Klal Yisrael to do, a little, you know, but a core, is to back off a little bit from that place, to create something that will be a source of inspiration for them, but it'll be outside of them. The image that when humanity creates an image to inspire them, it's the same as saying, I want to retain my autonomy, and when I want to be inspired, how I want to be inspired, to the degree that I want to be inspired, I'll choose it. The inspiration remains external to the person. So they fashion for themselves, Rav Moshe Shapira says, their own personal sense of awe. They create it, and then they can utilize it according to when they, you know, how they want it. They separate from themselves from their source of inspiration. In other words, the neck. They separate the heart, what drives them, from the knowledge that they have. That's the concept of a kashay oref. By creating an image, it's this imagery for that is having a very stiff neck. It's very, very hard. When a person wants to maintain their autonomy for what they know to be true here, to make its way here to what they want. Very, very difficult, because the ani, the I, gets in the way. And we said, remember many times this idea, that the Vilna Gaon says there are 50 times it says, in some form or another, I am Hashem asher hotzei sicha me'eretz Mitzrayim. Right? And that corresponds to the 50 gates of Tumah. Remember, they were on the 49th, and one more, they would have been kaput. 50 gates of Tumah. Tumah is degrees of separation from Hashem. The most difficult one to shatter, the one that exerts the greatest force upon a person that could only be attempted to shatter with the highest of the 50, which is an Aseres Adibras, a Matan Torah, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hetzisicha. That pronouncement by Hashem is supposed to shatter the most stubborn of all the gates or chambers of Tumah. That Anochi is supposed to shatter the Ani, right? And it didn't really work that well, right? And only to some degree in some very great people, and each person in some level. It's that difficult. And the natural response of a person is a avodah zarah. We don't have typical old-fashioned primitive image worship today. But the concept of the egel, which stays with us, is the very same. It hasn't really changed, which is a desire not to completely lose oneself to what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants, but to hold on desperately to the autonomy, the sense of self, and keep the inspiration according to my terms. Don't let it consume me. David HaMelech says in Tehillim that it has consumed him. He says, Toraska besoch mei. Your Torah is within me. It speaks for me. It's from my gut. That Madrega Klaisol, back away from. That's the concept of Kshei Oref. The Egel, okay, as in the Egla Arufa, as in the shore, as in the raging bull. The bull represents Kas, anger. Okay, what is anger related to Avodah Zarah? We know it's related because Chazal say, a Baal Kas, someone who lets themselves get angry, which can lead to every sin, right? Every sin is ultimately, in a state of anger, everything goes. Certainly Shvichas Damim, murder, right? So how is anger related to Avodah Zarah? Chazal say, whoever is a Baal Kas allows himself to get angry. Ki'ilu, it's like he has no God. He's like he's Oved Avodah Zarah, like he serves idols. What's the connection? What's the connection of being able to have rage at another person, to be angry at another person? So here's the thing. We think that creating an image, keeping the inspiration outside ourselves, only relates to Ben Adam Lamakom. I'll decide when I want to be inspired to elevate myself in Torah. But make no mistake about it, it very quickly degenerates into all the worst violations of Ben Adam L'Chavero, a man against man, because that means that if the truth, the inspiration, what I should aspire to is over there, and I'm the judge of when I access it or I'm not, that means that I'm the Baal Din, I'm the Shofet, I'm the judge. And if I'm the judge, then it's according to my perspective. It's the Ani. And then if it's according to my perspective and someone doesn't do things according to the way I see them, I can be angry at the other person to the point that I'll kill them, Shvichas Damim, and everything else. Or I have no concern for another person. And all the Ben Adam L'Chavero sins quickly follow suit, trot along once a person has separated themselves from the truth, from what they should know. So the concept of the Egla Rufa is this. A stranger comes to town. How is it that there's a dead body laying in, between the boundary between two towns? The real, idea at the core of it, where they break an egla, a little calf's neck, to show there was a separation. In other words, there's total sense of separation between myself and others, and what's right. In other words, when a stranger comes to town, what's supposed to happen is they're supposed to be welcomed, this achnasa sarchem, right, as one of us. That we take achrayas for that person. We take achrayas. We make sure they have food, and we make sure they have a bed, and we make sure that they're not alone at the mercy of the bandits in the forest, right? So we walk them out of town. We make sure they're secure because they're one of us. The same idea that I'm here and I decide what's right or wrong, the autonomy leads us not to feel achrayas for another person. So it could lead to murder, it could lead to negligent murder, it could lead to real homicide, real premeditated. It could also lead to negligence, it's lack of concern. So it's instantly Ben Adam L'Chaveru. Instantly all the sins between man and man have to do with this concept. Now that brings us back to a lot of other things. Yosef. What did Yosef want the brothers to convey to Yaakov? He wanted them to convey to Yaakov that not only am I a king, look at everything I have, but I see my role as king specifically to take responsibility for you and for the family. That's why I'm the king. He saw that his role as king was specifically, he was raised to that level specifically on account of the fact that he would take achrayus to help them, to preserve them, to make sure they survive. Now, by the way, I just want to mention, I meant to mention this a few times, tomorrow, tonight, it's my grandfather of Shimon Schwab Zatzal, his 16th Yahrzeit. And many of these ideas, like so many things you've heard so often, you know, are his ideas. What we're talking about today, for example, we've described, we've used my grandfather's little, I guess, mushel. He says, you know, you have to handcuff yourself. How many times have you heard me say this? Mm-hmm. Handcuff yourself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and throw away the key. So it's not outside, you know, it's not something you're forced to, but it's something you have and no more options about, right? And here, too, he says a word about Yosef. You know, Yosef, just to digress for a moment, but Yosef, you know, received these dreams, and he knew that he was destined to be a ruler. And yet, you know, we realize that, you know, Yosef didn't know how things would play out. Why would he be a ruler? Why would he be a great ruler? He had no idea. He didn't know how he'd come to be the ruler and why he was destined to rule. And certainly when he became king in Egypt, why was he destined to rule a foreign country? For what purpose? It wasn't clear yet. When the brothers, when the famine hit all the lands, including, some say including Eretz Yisrael, some say not as much, but when he saw the brothers bowing down to him, it says he recognized them, he saw them, he recognized them, he didn't say anything, he acted, you know, as if he was a stranger. And then, I'm sorry, when he first saw them, and then when they bowed down, then it says, "Vayizkar es chalomosav," he remembered his dreams, "asher cholam lahem," that he dreamed for them. My grandfather Zatzal says there that only at that point did he realize that all those dreams and his rise to power was lahem. It wasn't that he was going to be greater than them, it was that he was going to be greater for them. The whole thing was for Achrayus, not for self, that he was being promoted because there was something about him that he deserved to be promoted on his own account. He was being promoted only Lahem, to take care of them, to be their mefarnes, to be their benefactor. Then he realized that's the whole thing. That's why this whole thing happened, on account of Klal Yisrael, in his Achrayus to Klal Yisrael, to the future. So the message he sent back to his father with the agolos, with the egla arufa, that I still remember learning about egla arufa, he was saying, I am not guilty. I have taken achrayus for Klal Yisrael. I will treat them for my brothers for the future. I'm the Yosef that assumes total responsibility. I don't see them as other than me, outside of me, not my responsibility. I take the entire gamut of my ben adam lechavero responsibilities seriously. I'm that Yosef. Because the egla arufa represents that the separation we've made in our heads between spiritual things, ben adam lemakom things, is this close to separating from our responsibility in ben adam lechavero. There's no, one can't be separated from the other. Now, if a person argues, I'm not religious and I don't follow the laws, but I'm a good person and I take responsibility for my brethren, for ben adam lechavero, as much as a person's ben adam lechavero is intact, trust that, they don't know it, but you should let them know their ben adam lemakom is intact. Because their only way they would take achrayus for their brethren is they feel that everyone's a tzelem elokim, and everybody's not one against the other. It's not survival of the fittest. It comes from ruchnius that is deeply embedded in them, but not on their conscious level, an attachment to the sense of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, who's a Baal Chesed, and therefore they feel the urge to be a Baal Chesed too. That comes from God. That doesn't come from survival of the fittest. Doesn't come from any evolutionary process. It comes from a sense that everybody has dignity. That's the Tehillim Elokim. Comes from all the right places, whether they like it or not, whether they know it or not. I think I've told you this, but this is a little good experiment you can often do, right? Somebody says a little game you can play. Somebody, and this happens once in a while, they say, you know what? You don't need to be religious to be a good person. So if you want to bait them a little bit for a moment, and you say, well, you know what? I don't believe that. I don't think you can be a good person if you are not religious. Prove it. So they, of course, they get very offended. And they say, really? How could you think such a thing? All right, so you say, yeah, look, if you're a good person and you're not religious, tell me some good things you do. I don't believe you do any good things. So they say, I don't kill and I don't steal and I don't commit adultery and I respect my elders and I give charity. And that's usually the list with a couple more, the environment. And so what's the response? Say, that's lovely. Now, could you name anything that's not specifically from the Ten Commandments? In other words, it's all ruchnius. It's all what Hashem wants. They just don't realize that it's from the Ten. It's exactly what came to the world, you know, with Matan Torah. And people, well, they don't realize they're in touch with ruchnius. Where else do those aspirations come from, if not the Tzelem Elokim? That's the only place they come from. So the concept is that the first side of the luchos and the second side of the luchos go together. Look, everybody says that the Chet HaEgel is the same concept as the Chet Eitz Hadas, right? You've heard that? Eitz Hadas was in the origins of early humanity before time. This is a very important concept. The Eitz Hadas is a story that takes place in Sheishis Yimei Bereishis before they are banished from Gan Eden, which means before real time, before our history really starts. Anything that takes place in the Sheishis Yimei Bereishis, we're taught, is to be read. It's all the deepest mystical secrets. And it's there, the stories are there, not to be taken necessarily literally, as purely, simply literally, but all the stories and all the information about the time period of Sheishis Yimei Bereishis are there to tell us what is kavua, what is established, what is a given in the Bria, in creation, either in the natural world or in humanity, in our minds, in our psyche. And you know, as we've spoken about so often here, and it's back on a lot of old recordings, that the Chet of the Eitz Hadas was exactly this. The Isha, you know, is the I, the Ani, right? It's not just a woman. We're talking about the sense of autonomy, of responding to my gut interests and desires, right? And the Ish, so to speak, represents what's emes, what's true, the higher, the capacity of the mind to know, the expansion of the mind into ruchnius. They were one, right? That's the highest madrega. That's what we're talking about. That's freedom. That's tzelem Elokim. That's when what you do, what you have, the greatest pleasure is satisfying what you want to do anyway, which is the right thing. That's the oneness between the mind and the heart. They were separated, not by anybody's fault, not because it was a sin, because that's the way Hashem set up the world, that they're not one, and we have the job to reunite them. That's male and female coming back together. The Nachash, Rashi says straight away, doesn't say it was a snake. Not Rashi says, Zu Yetzahara. The Yetzahara is the force that doesn't want them as one. Same thing as the Chet HaEgel. Exact same thing. To separate, to isolate the inspiration, the passion, the desire, what drives me, put it outside of myself. Otherwise, there's no me left. And that stays us. So it's not that the sin was repeated. The original sin of the Eitz Hadas, of the Nachash, of all of that, didn't happen in our real time. The real sin, as it took place, was when Klal Yisrael became a nation by the Chet HaEgel. But the story of the Eitz Hadas teaches you that a human being, as an individual, Klal Yisrael, as a nation, go through phases of maturity. And right in the beginning, you can expect in our national life and in our personal life, the way we start out is a resistance to that ultimate achievement, and the way we end is finally desiring, letting go of our resistance, embracing that union, that oneness. That's the final end of our journey. So it's for a human being, that's how we start out. The whole nature of youth, right? The whole nature of youth is kshei oref. It's a sense of my way of seeing things. It's a sense of stubbornness. It's a sense of the way my perspective, not wanting to learn from the elders, not wanting to accept the inherited, accumulated wisdom of people, having to make all the mistakes ourselves, right? Having to learn it in, you know, through our own trial and error. That, we say, is the concept of stubbornness or azus, a certain arrogance, a certain sense of self. I'll decide, I'll figure out what's right or wrong. Eventually, after going through all the trial and error, we start like that. We get to a point way down where we want to know what's right and happily submit to it and stop fighting it because we've seen the, you know, the damages that come along the way. Now, we just talk about Erevav for a second. The Erevav are associated, my Shapiro says, he brings down a lot of sources, the concept of azus, that arrogance, that sense of self, refusing to be inspired. Whenever there's an opportunity to be inspired that can elevate a person, getting very objective, very distant from it, keeping it at bay. And now we know this. The last gullus was because of sinas chinam, ben adam l'chaveru. The last of the last challenges we just said, the fourth beast of Daniel, the Erev Rav, that's so intermingled with Klal Yisrael, it's hard to separate it. It's looked at, you know, but it's considered, it's really described as a husk on a kernel, an external part that has no life in and of itself, but it's attached to the kernel. And it takes a bunch of effort to separate it. That's the end. So sinas chinam, the slippery slope, being able to put myself against someone else because I just don't like them, because allowing myself to get angry, and all of those ben adam l'chaver midos, bad character traits, that comes from this separation, which we call the egla rufa. And in the end, we're told, what will be the nature of that last generation before Mashiach? Right? What's the famous description of that generation? Be'ikvas Mashiach, in the footsteps of Mashiach, what's going to happen? Chutzpah yaske, right? Be so much chutzpah. And all the empires will try to assert their own particular view of how to set up the world, right, as opposed to working with rules that have been established that work. It says, Chachma Sofrim Tisrach, nobody will respect Chachamim. People that fear sin will be disgraced. Truth will be trampled. The young will embarrass the old. The old will have to stand in deference to the young. A child will disgrace his parents, right? And we know all. And they say that finally it'll be considered like a dog, right? The last generation, you've heard this chazal, right? Be like pnei hakelev, like a dog that is considered azus. You know, has a certain sense. Azus is a certain arrogance or self. Dependence only on the self and my perspective. That is, in the end, the last ultimate bitter challenge. It comes from within the self. It doesn't come from outside at all. It comes from within the self to get to a point where we break our own sense, our insistence on that separation. The real truth is that once a person, you know, kind of allows that resistance to fall away and allows what's MS to inspire them and to push them forward, then they really begin to move in leaps and bounds. Unlike in certain things in Gashmias, the way it works in Ruchnias is different than often a lot of things in Gashmias. It is not the case that an empty vessel, right, can be most easily filled. In Ruchnias, the fuller the vessel, the more it can expand to absorb more. So the more a person allows the Shefa, which comes from Hashem, unlike, in other words, the influence that comes from allowing and, you know, reducing our own sense of self to affect them, to take down the barriers and all the boundaries and the filters that hold it at bay, then the person begins to grow and grow more and grow more because they're open. Otherwise, they're always closed, too many mechitzas. This is the ultimate challenge of human beings. Notice, by the way, again, early on in Bereishis, the first sin which brought death into the world was the Eitz HaDaas, Ben Adam L'Makom, regular death. Para aduma, the red cow, that there's tuma, right? But the next great sin was what? It was not very long between it was between one person rising up in hatred, in a sense of being insulted or offended, right? Their sense of self, you know, tainted, you know, touched, you know, to all of a sudden you have murder. You have murder, and that brings with it the egla arufa. That so what the egel is a ben adam lachavero, is comes from a mother ben alpaka. I'll mention this one more time. I've mentioned this before, but it's an excellent example of avodah zarah. We think of avodah zarah as a sin against God. The message here is it's instantly changes from a sin against God to a sin against humanity. It just that's automatic. You can't be distinguished. We took our kids to see a few years ago a documentary called Blind Sight, right? Remember this? About Tibet. Basically, to go without the whole thing, they're idol worshippers. So there's a lot of blindness all over Tibet, a lot of blindness. So the kids that are blind, they turn blind because of pollution, because they have no doctors, because they have no hospitals, because they know nothing, because they're backwards, because they're fatalists, they believe in the gods. So the kids go blind because of the pollution and the disease all over the place. And then they're abandoned and abused and left to starve on the streets. And nobody tries to heal them because what's the point of healing them? The snake god cursed them. They are cursed by the gods. Who am I to come in and interfere with the will of the gods? So they even have footage of an old lady screaming at these blind, starving kids who burned with cigarettes and physically abused and beaten. They have a footage, an old lady screaming, "You're cursed by the snake god. You're not even good enough to eat your father's carcass." In other words, I told my kids, avodah zarah, believing in other forces, keeping God at bay, right? So there are forces outside of you that you turn to when you need. Believing in avodah zarah is not a sin against God. It instantly transforms itself, morphs into a sin against humanity. It's evil, it's brutal, it's vicious. It destroys any compassion for another human being because everything that's important is outside. I'm the source, and what I think is the ultimate, and everything else is God is outside, my inspiration is outside, other people are outside of me. It's all nothing that I'm connected to. So there's no distinction between the egel and the egla rufa. So our job goes to the tikkun on the egel, the tikkun on avodah zarah. And by the way, one more thing, haronaf, the raging, right? We said that the neshama comes in through the nose, right? The in-breath, the concept, the imagery of haronaf is an exhale. Shh. It's as if Hashem is telling us, by doing this, you're exhaling your neshama from within you. You're expelling it. The only tikkun on this, obviously, is a sense of achrayus to other people, and that's very close to achrayus HaKadosh Baruch Hu, achrayus to one's own neshama. There are three categories, ben adam lamakom, ben adam lachavero, and ben adam laatzmo, person to their own neshama, which is similar to ben adam lamakom, right? So the one leads to the next. From ben adam lachavero, you become closer. It's automatic. It connects you ben adam lamakom, and ben adam lamakom obviously forces you into ben adam lachavero. They're united, and we know that's our gullus. Is the sinas chinam. So both of these, that's the brings us to the tikkun on these things. Okay. Oh, important announcement. The shul is having a dinner this Motzei Shabbos. Everybody, please, $10 something if you don't mind. That gratitude to the shul for hosting this. Many people here don't go to the shul. We use the benefits of the shul. Will everyone stop in the office and just give a small donation on behalf of the shir? I'm also giving my own personal ad and donation in gratitude to the hospitality we are offered here.
I appreciate it.
Okay, everybody, have a good week. Right, Purim Katzen Sma.